Are we on we on the reunion?
Yes, you've already used that, eh?
Ah, I
used
did.
It like 5 mood skills ago, eh?
5 mood skills ago?
Yeah. You want to play some Ghetto Boys or something?
Damn, homie.
All right, here we go.
Okay. What are we at? 38?
No,
we're
right.
Fast we're, approaching.
We're at 39. I haven't saved it yet.
Ah, you tricked me again, dude.
Tricked you again.
Let's rewind this bad boy, dude. This isn't going well so far.
If you ever listen to the mood skills, you know that we're on 39, but go ahead.
Nah, I'm not really a numbers guy.
You want to start over?
I'm a Paul Heyman guy.
Okay.
But not necessarily a numbers guy.
But you don't want to start over?
Nah.
Okay, you got it. Okay, good.
All right, so.
That's probably. You fucking up this intro is probably the best intro you've done this whole time.
You like
so
it, huh?
I like it. Good job. Good job.
It's called sarcasm.
Oh, okay.
It doesn't always come across, but I think this time it wasn't too bad. All right, so we're like second Raw.
That was a cat's toy.
Terrible. Second Raw removed from.
Why is it terrible that my cat has
for
a toy?
For me.
Oh, for you. Okay. All right.
That cat, vicious. Doesn't really like me too much.
She's
very territorial.
She wasn't kayfabe on you, huh?
No, she works stiff.
She's a shoot.
She works stiff on me. So, yeah, we're about, you know, the second Raw removed from SmackDown, which we enjoyed, and it's been a pretty good week. I think the thing I want to start talking about is Shield.
Okay.
Mostly,
we don't have to go down the line. Like we can like open up this show up.
Yeah,
and stuff.
Well,
there's some ideas that you had. And
yeah, well, I'm just going straight to Shield.
They're good ideas.
And I want
to hit one thing on Raw, but let's go ahead and start off with the Shield. And
sure.
What you got to say?
Well, I mean, I think the momentum is coming back. I mean, they're not necessarily winning at the clip that they were before, but they're still really like the workhorse group of the shows, and they've moved up back to. Going against higher profile competition. You know, I thought, even though it wasn't a match on its own, just the work from Daniel Bryan and Seth Rollins, I thought that was the best match going on the night for sure. It was kind of one of those things that it's funny because, you know, you DVR Raw and you know it's a 3-hour show. I don't know what your DVR says, but it always gives 3 hours and 21 minutes on mine. I see they got a gauntlet match going, and it starts at 2 hours and 57 minutes.
And you're sweating.
I'm like, well, and I wasn't sweating because I knew they'll go over, but I was like, okay, well, you know, is this going to be like 3 minutes of Seth Rollins, and then we're going to see a lot of Reigns and or a longer Reigns or a longer Ambrose match? But they really treated it like it was a main event between Daniel Bryan and Seth Rollins. It's kind of funny too because I thought as recently we were talking about some of the higher spots and whatnot. I think Seth Rollins looked like he was digging deeper into the bag of tricks. He
pulled out that
reverse DDT.
Yeah.
And that I thought that was a really good spot. I thought it looked great. But they gave him a full 10, maybe 15 minutes of just the two of them.
There was a lot of good spots in that match.
Yeah, and yeah. I thought it was a great match. And then you had Rollins getting out of a few areas where you don't think, like, because you kind of look at, even though, you know, I kind of consider, as far as work goes, I kind of think Rollins and Ambrose are pretty equal, but you see a lot more of Rollins kind of just like jobbing and doing kind of taking bumps, where Ambrose is usually kind of coming through in the matches a little bit more.
Well, it's funny that you say that, and I'm cutting you off, but I see like Ambrose more of kind of like in a CM Punk mold in terms of the way he performs his matches. And after watching Rollins and Daniel Bryan, I definitely see Rollins as more of a kind of in the mold of a Daniel Bryan. And if he can kind of mirror his career in terms of what he does in the ring, I think he has a bright future, just like all three of them do. But yeah, it really showcased him, and you kind of had a feeling that this guy had a lot of talent, but Ambrose just takes over because he's so WWE ready right now. And I think this is just opening the door for Rollins, and yeah, I think you're right 100%. Yeah.
Well, and I mean, I think Ambrose has the better overall package right now just because he's so much better on the mic. You know, not a slight to Rollins, but, you know, Ambrose is one of the best guys they got on the mic right now. So sometimes I think Rollins and Reigns get a little overshadowed and just because Ambrose is such a presence. But this is probably one of the longer matches where Rollins got to just kind of show off what he can do. I think it's probably the best match he's had, to be honest.
Yeah, by far, in the WWE.
Yeah, in the WWE. And on top of that, I thought, you know, a little slightly tangent, but on Friday SmackDown, I thought Reigns and Rollins, without Ambrose, cut a great promo. I think Reigns is really coming along on his mic work. Not that he's as clever as these guys, but, like, when to kind of... I don't know. I just think he's a little better in what he says and when to be that intense guy and when to kind of
when he talks real quiet. Then he talks real loud.
A little bit, but I thought it worked.
Right? No vein of a Bruce the Bard Beefcake. But he was terrible like that. But yeah, no, I agree with you. 100%.
Yeah, and so like I think those two are kind of rounding a little out into like guys that can just be good on their own, right? I think with this whole thing, with this corporate evolution is happening or whatever you want to call it. I think they're bringing the Shield in great on that angle. I think, Orton, I don't necessarily want to get into all that, but it's good. I could see maybe, you were saying bring back Batista, which I kind of assume was tongue in cheek, but I think maybe even, you're going to see maybe Wade Barrett be that guy. And I think it's a really good way that they bring in they bring Shield back up to main event level. You got Randy Orton, and then you're going to take a guy that's been floundering like Wade Barrett, and just by having him in that crew, I think it elevates everybody. So I think even though kind of the promos are kind of plateauing between what Triple H is doing and I'm a little worried Randy's taking a step back a little bit.
Taking a step back as a champion, but yeah.
Well, just in what his character was when he was kind of on his own was really kind of it had really probably been the best stuff he's done in a few years, and now he's got to take a back seat to Triple H on the mic, which I don't necessarily like. But
that's a good point that you brought up. I didn't think about that. But yeah, I mean, this is a chance for him to really take off as a heel champion,
right?
And really kind of be the centerpiece of everything. But now it's kind of it's kind of a thing where this guy, Orton's never really had a chance to do anything. I mean, yeah, he's been a champion for 10 times, but it's always been a specific role. They've never given him the yoke and said, go ahead and take it, or the reins and do what you can. There's always some other guy that either stops him or it's a time for him when he's champion to push someone up into a super babyface status.
The greatest transitional champion of all times?
Could be, yeah. Yeah. And I haven't thought about that, but now that you say it, I can kind of agree with that. A couple things with Rollins and Bryant, there was a lot of wild spots in there. Just with the wrestling and the stuff that was going on. That German suplex off the top rope was totally unexpected. I thought it was just going to be like a regular German suplex, but he does a flip.
Yeah. And Rollins sold the hell out of it too.
And I haven't seen that in such a long time. The only thing that I can really kind of get mad about that whole aspect was. I really like Daniel Bryan's new finisher. I think it's a perfect finisher.
Yeah, and the cameraman boxing.
Yeah, they're showing everybody saying yes, and it's like, wait, show that.
They come back and he's already laid out.
And it's kind of one of those things where you really got to see it on SmackDown, but they don't show a lot of replays of it, and it's always at the wrong angle. I think it's kind of one of those things where it's one of those moves that's really a high-impact move, and I don't know if WWE is really behind it. Just kind of what I've been seeing, when it was the pay-per-view, they never showed the replay of it.
Not a close-up, right?
Yeah, not a close-up of it. So, yeah, I mean, maybe it's the whole PG thing that they're trying to maintain, but I really like that finisher. I thought it was really good.
I don't know that it's the PG thing as much as, it's such a different move than anybody else is doing, especially as a finisher, that maybe they just haven't quite figured out where they need to put the camera when he's doing it.
Yeah.
And maybe it could be something that Daniel Bryan, is such a flow guy that, they don't necessarily even know when he's coming out with it.
Yeah.
So it could be one of those two things. I'm sure at some point, they'll figure it out because that's one thing that they're pretty good with, the camera work and getting the angles. I think they'll figure it out. But, that cameraman definitely pulled a Sin Cara on that one.
Sin Cara was the cameraman. What are you talking about? Yeah.
No, I don't think he could be. He's only got four fingers.
The four-finger special. Raw was kind of, it did the job. It was good. I did a lot of fast forwarding this one. I actually passed out last night, coaching soccer and doing all this stuff and everything. Kind of get tired after a while. A couple things, the Paul Heyman, CM Punk stuff and everything that happened with it, it was good. I thought it was a good match, but really in the spots that I usually fast forward, like when Paul Heyman's talking or when he's beating up on CM Punk, the stuff I usually don't want to see just because I've seen it so many times. But the guy's mic work during the whole thing was worth watching. And I just really, we say this all the time, but Paul Heyman really makes you watch things you normally don't want to see, like if it's a promo or something like that. Like Paul Heyman, you sit there and you watch the guy because he can get so much heat. He's so good on the mic. you know, when he's smacking CM Punk with the kendo stick, saying "I loved you" and stuff, and "I was your father figure," and then the promo after he's crying and everything like that. I just thought it's just like a nice element to it, and that's all I really want to say on it. I don't think you need to say anything on it. I don't think I need to say anything more. I just think it's good, and it's more of the same, and he does the job. He's a great heel guy, and it just really shows.
What I'll add to it is this. I really like the fact that they took like this whole thing of CM Punk and Paul Heyman, and they made a really great feud out of it, and they're able to, one, go ahead and make a great match between Punk and Brock Lesnar. But then you kind of look at that and you say, as good as it was, it's a little bit limited because Lesnar is like a part-time guy, and you know he's not going to be there week in, week out. But like the overall, like the long-lasting impact that I see is, I think this feud is going to make Curtis Axel. Curtis Axel, he's still really, really green on the mic. But like, as we've said, or as I've kind of like said, when you have guys like Ryback or whatever, you want to push him, guy can't talk for shit. You need to put him with someone that can do the talking for him. And by the fact that Heyman's doing the talking for Axel, it ends up being okay. But there's no question that Axel can work. And so the more matches he's going to have with CM Punk, it's really, I think, going to thrust Curtis Axel as a guy that people, I think they're going to hate him because he's a heel, one, he's with Heyman, two, and he's kind of has a boring personality. But I think that might be good for him. I think ultimately he can get a lot of heat out of that. And that's kind of the thing I was thinking about when I'm watching this match is like, you know, and I don't want to take this back to the whole thing where we go after Cena, right? But like the main criticism I have is like, okay, how many times has he put somebody over, right? Like, he'll take a guy that's hot like Daniel Bryan, a guy that's hot like CM Punk, and have a match, and if they win, they win. And then, oh yeah, I put this guy over. But would you ever see him go to a guy like Curtis Axel and say, like, I'm going to make you? No, like, they always have to be to a certain level before he gets involved. And CM Punk is even though it's a Heyman thing, I mean, this whole thing is just like, you know, he'll job to Axel. Like, I have no doubt that at some point he'll lose a match to Axel. And it's really going to elevate him once this whole thing gets through. So, like, it's something that I don't, you know, I think CM Punk does that Cena doesn't. And one of the other reasons why, like, for the overall business side of it, best in the world.
Yeah, definitely best in the world. You kind of said you're talking about Cena doing the job for someone, or CM Punk jobbing for Curtis Axel. He doesn't need a job for the guy. He doesn't need to lose for him to elevate Curtis Axel. I thought that match that they had on Raw really showcased stuff that Axel can do. Mm-hmm. And him just being in the match with CM Punk, whoever wins or whoever loses, it doesn't matter. John Cena, in order for him to put someone over, he needs to lose. He can't have a match. John Cena can't have a match with anybody and put that guy over because John Cena is very limited within himself because his matches are very booked and you already know what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. CM Punk, you don't know what's going to happen. It was kind of funny during the whole match. You have the three-man crew of Cole, JBL, and King, and they're kind of talking about something else, and then CM Punk put his go to sleep out of nowhere, and the King actually kind of had to like sound all excited to kind of get JBL and Cole back focused back on the match because it kind of pretty much came out of nowhere. Yeah. So yeah, I agree with you. I think Axel is coming out. Axel is coming into a point where you know he's going to lose to CM Punk, but you know he has enough stuff in the ring where he's going to put on a good match, and you know CM Punk is going to put on a good match with anybody. And it's more of a case where Axel's getting the rub a little bit from CM Punk just sure. with the work he's doing. So yeah, I agree with you on that.
Well, and I think I'll let you finish, but like, he is getting the rub by losing a match like that, but I think the thing is, you know that this thing between Cena, between Heyman and Punk is going to be prolonged, and they're probably going to wrestle like week after week, and I do think like Hennig will take a couple matches.
Well, even
and
that's the thing. Even like, the pay-per-view elimination handicap match, you're already thinking, okay, if he can get Axel out pretty fast, and then he can get out. Then he can just have Paul Heyman by himself. I mean, it makes you stop and think like how the match is going to work instead of it just being like a 2-on-1. Mm-hmm. And if it's a 2-on-1, you know CM Punk's going to win, but the whole elimination aspect really kind of heightens that up. So it's a good job. I like what the WWE is doing right now, where people are winning, people are losing. It's not the same people over and over again. Primetime players are getting a little push that they've beaten the real Americans a lot and stuff like that. But just little things like that. People are winning, people are losing. I like the way just the whole aspect of it. Even the point that I really didn't want to get into, I've kind of been on Twitter with it a little bit, but having the two Puerto Rican guys, Primo and Epico, become...
Los Matadores?
Yeah, which kind of offends me as a Puerto Rican, because there's no bullfighting in Puerto Rico. But the thing is that you know that if they play it the right way, you know they're gonna get over. And it was a lot better than what they're doing now, because they had no personality, they had nothing. Now you kind of have like some good kind of production spots, kind of like a la it's like the Wyatt family. Not to the Wyatt family effect, but at least they're having fun with it.
It kind of reminds me of the Conquistadors, right? It's like the old Conquistador gimmick. For all I know, like they'll only be those guys for a couple of months, and then they'll have someone else in the suits, and Epico and Primo will be wrestling them.
Yeah,
right. And Matador One and El Matador Dos.
Yeah. So before we get it, I don't want to spend a lot of time on Raw, because I know you have a lot of good stuff. We're going to kind of make it like a Q&A type mood of scale. Mm-hmm. The one thing that I want to kind of give where credit's due is we talk about the Diva division, and we always talk about AJ and how she kind of makes that Diva division. Now, I'm not going to talk about Natalya. I think Brie, over the past like 3 or 4 matches that I've seen her do, I think she's been a very effective heel, just really good heel type work, always working the submission and just doing a lot of heel tactics. I've been really impressed with what she's done in terms of storytelling in the ring. And we were kind of talking about like Eve, and it's been such a long time since we've seen Eve or even talked about her, but Eve kind of incorporating... Okay.
I read online she's going to be in the Scorpion King #4.
Okay, well, I don't think it's going to be released in the movie, so it's straight to DVD.
So the premiere is going to be right here.
Where? In San Jose?
In your living room.
It's going to be in my living room? Oh, okay, all right.
Straight to DVD.
Are my pants going to be in it?
Not if I'm here.
That's bad. What? What?
If they are not, then I won't be here.
Okay,
is what I meant to say.
All right, good.
I apologize.
Fucking
okay, we got to start over now. cut.
Hey, Jason, cut that.
Cut. Can you get some Jim Rome type editing over here? The golf course looks good.
I feel great. I like my chances. But I just want to... It's just a nice dynamic to see, once again. The reason I brought up Eve is because when she started incorporating kind of the Gracie holds and stuff and everything, it kind of brought nice pacing to the match. And I'm not saying Bree's the greatest technician in the wrestling ring, but she definitely has her own style. She also says something to the point of, with her sister being hurt, that she's kind of had to...
She got lower back problems after the implants?
Yeah, something like that. And it's because she's fat. Everybody on Twitter says she's fat, and like it starts like big Twitter wars. You wouldn't know like the Twitter wars that get started, because they're like, she's not fat, she's just big boned or something. But
I mean, she's definitely thickened up, but I'm not at that at all.
Yeah. That's whatever.
That's neither here nor there.
Yeah, I don't want to talk about what's her name being fat.
I wasn't trying to get into the debate. I was just putting my 2 cents.
Continue. Okay, but. You know, she kind of posted something saying that with her sister not being around, she's had to do stuff in the ring that she's... Because usually, like, her sister was kind of like the ringleader, and now she's kind of learning the craft, and her being with Daniel Bryan and stuff and everything. It's just, she's a good Twitter follower, she's a good Instagram follow. I'm just giving her props for actually trying to learn how to wrestle and kind of tell a story. She's very vocal in the ring. She plays heel tactics perfect, and that's what you need to do to kind of save the Divas division, is to have... You know, give them some time and not just do the same. Don't try to wrestle like a man, you know, and try to do like a clothesline that is weak and there's supposed to be high impact. It just looks like shit. You know, when I think about the knockouts, it's like the knockouts will do things that tailor to their specific skill set.
Yeah.
And her skill set is to put submissions and stuff and talk to the ref and sound like a mean bitch in the ring, and it works for her. So
it's funny because I wanted to talk about that segment too. But I would like, so you see it as like the match part of it. I thought, hands down, AJ cut the best promo out of anybody on Raw. Hands down. I thought that promo was great, actually. She spoke a lot of truth. She hit hard on a lot of different subjects. It's funny because as I told you, I haven't come out with this information before, but I have been watching Total Divas, and she had one comment of that your boyfriend what's his name, Tyson Kidd, like, isn't even a man. And, like, my whole takeaway watching the last two episodes was, dude, Tyson Kidd's a little bitch. Like, I like him in the ring, but, and I know it's scripted, so I'm not trying to say, like, that's how he really is, but the way he's come off in the last two shows, dude, that guy's a little bitch ass. So, like, I thought it was great how she incorporated that, like her whole little spiel about, in the 1 year I've been here, I've accomplished more than all you combined in your entire careers. And that's a pretty legitimate thing to say. I mean, I don't even know that Natalya's ever been women's champion, and she was also the GM. So, I mean, I thought it was a great promo, and by, hands down to me, the best of the night. So yeah, I mean, I thought the match was good. The match was fine. But you're also getting the showcase of AJ as, like, someone that doesn't even have to get in the ring and do a match to have probably to still be, like, the most effective diva on the roster. So I think it bodes well. Still not as good a division as Knockouts by far, but, like, I think it's getting better. So I can leave it at that with that segment if you can. But, yeah, that's what I saw. I thought that promo was awesome by far.
And what the Knockouts division does in the ring, I think the WWE does in terms of storytelling. So, and that's pretty much what sets WWE apart from TNA, is that their storytelling is on point. The way their gimmicks that they introduce, most of them work all the time, Fandango excluded, The Miz excluded. But yeah, I mean, they're in a good place right now. The promo that the Wyatts cut was a great promo. Just kind of makes you think, like, who the fuck are these guys? And he kind of introduces his little Sister Abigail finisher and stuff and everything. So, yeah, it worked really good. So, let's not keep on talking about a Raw that's kind of just like kind of a position Raw where nothing major happens. I think we can kind of do what you wanted to do for the past couple weeks.
Okay. Let me do one more thing. And this is it's not specific to this Raw, but it's kind of I can lead it into what I've been wanting to do anyway. And you mentioned really quickly earlier how primetime players have started to win some matches. And I can't help but notice that all this is coming after, like, Darren Young comes out that you know, he's gay, which I got no problem with. I'm, like, that's not, we're here to, like, judge on that or him in any way. But just to me, it's like, okay, you had this tag team that was on the cusp. They could have pushed at any point in time over the past year. Of really good workers, and never ever got a push. Always just job. Then Darren Young comes out with his sexuality, and all of a sudden they won like the last 4 weeks straight. And like I don't know how I feel about that. And I was kind of curious how you feel about that. I mean, do you think any way that a guy can get over and get a push is fine? I was fine. I would have liked to see them have gotten their push like months ago. So I'm fine with it that they're finally getting it, but I kind of feel a little like WWE's being
conspiracy theory.
Not even conspiracy. That's not the word. It's like exploiting. Which I mean, I know that's what they do, but I mean, of all times, why now to get this guy pushed? And do you have a problem with him getting the push now, as compared to, you know, after they had done the job for about a year and a half?
If the WWE came out and said Darren Young is gay, and he's our first gay. He's like our first like publicly gay superstar, and then they started pushing him to win. I would have a problem with it. I don't have a problem with this for a couple reasons. One, I thought Darren Young, you know, the bar from your boy was just straight man's game. Just with that whole TMZ. I mean, you heard the interview and stuff, right? And just the way it was nonchalant. He just said it, and the TMZ guy was just like blown away and just going like, "Wow, you're so." Brave and stuff, and Darren Young was just like, "No, I'm not, dude. I'm like, this is who I am."
Yeah, it wasn't like it was like, "Hey, everybody gather around, check this one out," right? It was just the guy brought up the question and he answered the question.
So, I mean, the conspiracy theorists can say that, you know, that since he's kind of in the spotlight, you know, that the media, if you can call it TMZ media, they're gonna look at WWE more, you know, with more scrutiny, saying like, "Oh, well, yeah, this guy is gay, but he always loses. This is the only place that a gay guy has in your company, is that he has a job all the time." Mm-hmm. Now, in no way, shape, or form is any journalist right now, whether in newspapers or media outlets or TV or anything like that, know shit about wrestling in the first place, because they're fucking idiots. I mean, the whole thing about journalists, a little inside secret, is that we used to do stories that we had no idea what the fucking story was about. And you have to be, like, you have to be an expert, like, within, like, 2 days of everything. And you're not going to get the full picture. So there's no, except for minus some of the papers in the South or in Florida, there's no journalist right now that knows a shit about wrestling. They don't know a lick about what happens, the intricacies of it. So it's very easy for them to say, like, oh, well, this guy loses. And I don't think that's the reason why WWE's doing it. I think he's getting his push because he came out and because he made news. But the way that he made news, it wasn't a setup. He just said what it was. And what I want to say that's going to trump everything is that Titus O'Neil and Darren Young, they're ready. They're ready. Titus O'Neil is great in the ring. Darren Young is the weaker of the two. But it's Titus O'Neil's time, dude. It's time for him to, like, to start winning and see what he can do as a singles wrestler. If they have to establish that with them as the primetime players right now, and if they can get over and people are liking them, what's the big deal? I don't personally have a problem with them getting a push of them winning, because the guys that they're getting a push from is from the Real Americans, which is, I think, is a gimmick that's really boring. I think Zeb is fine. I think he does the heel tactic fine, but having Antonio Cesaro and having Jack Swagger say "We the People," and then even having, like, other people saying "We the People," you know, like the fans saying "We the People." It's like, I just, to me, that's more hateful than anything else. You know, it's like, I don't like. First of all, I don't like Cesaro being relegated to having to do that, because he has a lot more talent than what he is. I mean, he should have been the flipping Paul Heyman guy. You know, I mean, it's, and then to have, like, dumbass fans, like, get behind racist comments, this, that, and this, because they think it's cool. I have more of a problem with that. To allow dumb people to be like, oh yeah, you know, like, we're gonna say "We the People," you know. And to me, I have more of a problem with that than Darren Young getting a push because he's made news that he's a gay superstar, or whatever you want to say about that.
Yeah, that's fine. No, I was just curious what you thought about it, because I don't think it was contrived in that Vince said, hey, why don't you do this, and, like, you know, we'll get you a rub off it. I don't think it was anything like that. I think it was completely genuine, like you said.
I think the best thing out of the whole thing is that WWE didn't come out with anything official about it. You had a lot of superstars, like, congratulating him. Yeah. But it wasn't like a case where WWE came out and said, like, Darren Young admitted that he was gay. We as a company don't do that. It's like, they didn't even do that. They just let it be what it was. The whole thing was that he said what he wanted to say when he wanted to say it. He was being honest with himself. He didn't hide behind it. He stood up, and when the question was asked to him, he said exactly what he wanted to say. It wasn't played. It wasn't contrived. He stood up for what he believed in, and he didn't hide from it.
Yeah.
It's like, it's no different from you being proud that your family is from Hawaii, or me being proud that I'm from Puerto Rico, and there's no flipping matadors in Puerto Rico. You know, to me, that's what it is. This is who he is. He said who he is. And WWE didn't try to either make money off of it or try to extenuate it and stuff. I mean, they made a little bit of references here and there that Darren Young made news, but they never said what the news was.
Yeah.
And I thought it was the right way to deal with the whole thing.
All right. That's fine. Yeah, ultimately, I guess that was just a question I had, because, like, the bottom line for me is I would have liked to see the primetime players get pushed, but it's almost like one of those, like, what's the word I'm looking for? Reverse bias things, like, he came out, so let's give him the push. I think they deserve it. I'm not questioning whether they deserve to get that push, but I would have rather seen it come because of their abilities, and not like, oh, hey, let's capitalize.
But see, the WWE didn't come out and, like, start pushing as straight baby faces and, like, you got to treat these guys.
Right.
It's organic. The fans are the ones that...
I think they've kind of been behind them for a month or so anyway.
Yeah.
But they still lost all the time.
Yeah, they still lost all the time. But they lost.
And I would like to definitely see Darren Young get a legitimate finisher before they get any kind of real push. But if he can come out and do that, hey, man, the sky's the limit for those guys.
They're letting the fans decide whether they're going to vote for these or cheer for these guys. And I really think even before Darren Young came out, people really saw that Titus O'Neil was the real deal. And I think people like Titus O'Neil because he was changing his gimmick up and everything. And they would boo, but it's kind of the whole thing where you're booing the guy. It's kind of like the whole Ziggler thing, right? It's like people booed Ziggler, but they knew he had the goods. And then once they put him in a position against heels or whatever, it's like you have two heel teams. Well, over the course of time, they started cheering Ziggler because they realized he was good. I feel it's the same with the primetime players.
Yeah.
You have two heel teams, and it's not like they're not doing anything different than what they were doing before. They're doing the exact same thing that they were doing before. They're not doing so much as heel tactics as they were before, like actually inside the ring. But all the, but their dance, the dance that they do, the whistle they do,
yeah,
it's fan friendly.
Yeah, okay. No, I just wanted to get your thoughts on that because I kind of thought it was an interesting question.
It was interesting. Good job. It was an interesting.
Thank you. Just as a quick aside, you know, you mentioned how you're offended by these Los Matadors. Would you be more on board if they were like, instead of bullfighters, like cockfighters? Would that be a little bit more, would you respect that more as a Puerto Rican?
I'd be happy if they were wife beaters, white wife beaters. They would go to Puerto Rican parades and they'd get in fights at the end, because you never go to a Puerto Rican parade because it's all fine and dandy in the beginning, but 2 or 3 hours later when people are getting drunk, there's always a fight that breaks out.
But if they were like cockfighters, right? Maybe they could like hide a blade in the boot, right? And then they could bring blading back.
But here's the whole thing is that with the Matadors is that there's a part of me that sits there and is going like, really, you need to give two Puerto Ricans this gimmick, you know, like a Mexican gimmick or a Mexican gimmick for this whole thing. But the whole thing, when they come out, I know I'm going to be behind it because I know they're going to play it right, and I know I'm probably going to like it. I'm going to like them a lot more as the Matadors as compared to what I do as Primo Epico, because they suck as Primo and Epico. So anything that gets good workers over and they can maybe see what they can do with this gimmick, by all means, go ahead and do it. I mean, I say I'm offended. It's more tongue in cheek than anything else. But you know, it's.
You didn't think I was serious about the cockfighting thing, did you?
No, I didn't think. Okay. No, okay. As much as I think you're serious about really liking really liking John Cena. You know, you saying cockfighting, that really offends me, dude. Somewhere Lillian Garcia is like shaking her head.
You're over there like, no, that's not us. That's the Dominicans.
What offends me is that Alberto De Rio's face is so fucked up right now that he has to wear mascara and stuff. And so when he's done with the match, you see like big mascara tears and stuff and everything. Have you seen that guy's? I mean, that guy's face is just all ripped up, dude.
You know what happened, right?
Did he get in a car accident or something?
No, he got in the night before SummerSlam. He got in a fist fight with some fans, and you know who came to his rescue?
Christian?
Drew McIntyre, dude.
Drew McIntyre.
Drew McIntyre had the parking lot running.
You don't mess with the, was he a Scottish dude?
The Sinister Scott.
Yeah. So here we go. I'm talking about being offended, and then we start talking about a guy from Scotland.
Hey, he stood up for the Mexican. Good for him.
Nah, he stood up for one of the boys. And yeah. Yes. Nah, hey, and that just proves the show. That just shows you that you don't mess with wrestlers, because one of them, if you got one down, someone else is going to come to the rescue and handle business. So good for Drew McIntyre. It's too bad they can't take that and make this guy more exciting than 3MB.
And I agree with that, what you say about wrestlers standing up for one another. And I think with you saying that, there's probably no better time than for us to go into the new segment.
Wow, look at that. Oh, the new segment.
The new segment.
You want to start right now?
I mean, I think we should.
I put the music all the way at like...
Oh, you want it?
All the way at the hour, I thought. We can do that. I thought you wanted to do some Q&As, but let me...
We can do that.
Just keep on talking.
Q&As.
Yeah, I mean, we're kind of... Hopefully I don't lose the whole podcast by doing stuff I'm not supposed to be doing, which looks like will probably happen. So I don't want to mess with that right now, because I can't...
But if you're concerned, we can do it at the hour mark. That's fine.
Okay.
Let's hit the Hall of Kayfabe then.
You want to hit the Hall of Kayfabe right now?
Yeah, well, if we're doing Ning 101 at the hour mark, let's do Hall of Kayfabe.
I thought you had like all these Q&As.
I got them.
Okay.
But I don't want to go, what is this, amateur hour? We're going to go segment right into segment. Let's go segment, some more stuff, then we'll go segment again.
Okay.
All right, so, you know, last week, I think I kind of surprised you a little bit pulling Regal out of the hat. So this week, I want to make sure we hit on a guy that's one of your guys. So you could speak extensively. I got two names here. Both of them I consider to be kind of your guys. Kind of tossing up.
Is one of them a Four Horsemen or both of them Four Horsemen?
One of them is, and one of them was in another faction.
Was in another faction. Okay.
Well,
I don't know who they are. Just throw out the name and let's go from there.
All right. I'm gonna go with the other faction because you'll figure it out if I don't do it now. Then let's go with one Michael P.S. Hayes.
All right.
Now, Michael P.S. Hayes, I don't have a whole lot of wealth of knowledge of him. I didn't see a whole lot of Freebirds matches. I know he was good. I know he was great on the mic. Ascended to power later on. Maybe kind of considered a dick by some in the back. But, like, I know, like, you know, there was some pretty legendary stuff going against the Four. And I'm just going to get out of the way and let you talk about the fabulous Freebird, Michael PSAs.
Well, you act like I've seen a lot of Michael PSAs matches as well. I haven't seen a lot. I've probably maybe seen a handful. A couple things that really stick out for me with Michael PSAs, and this is back when I was younger, because there's another thing that kind of stuck out as well. I saw, there was like some dumb movie that I saw, and it was like some like Terminator knockoff, and I have no idea what the name of the movie was. But they had a guy walking through an arena while a wrestling match was going on. And the wrestler that was in the ring was Michael PSAs. And just what he did in that first 5 minutes of that movie.
Of the movie?
Yeah, and it made me a big fan. I was like, oh, shit. I'm like, who's this guy? And then I saw him on TV like the next day on WCW, and I was like, oh, shit, that's Michael PSAs. And that was kind of like it's kind of funny. Like, I remember watching wrestling because he had the WWF product and he had the WCW stuff. And I think I started becoming a really big fan when I started like kind of looking at WCW, because nobody knew who these guys were. Everybody kind of knew WWF, and I didn't like the guys that everybody else liked. You know, I didn't like the whole package product of the WWF.
Ultimate Warrior.
Yeah, I didn't like any of those guys. And the reason why I started turning to WCW is just because they had these guys that. Some of them look formidable enough. Like, you had Lex Luger's, and you're looking at Lex Luger going like, wow, like, this guy is a freak of nature. But then you had these, like, regular guys that, I mean, they weren't overly big. They weren't, like, built. They didn't have, you know, didn't have a ton of muscles upon muscles. And you looked at their ring work, and you kind of looked at the showmanship that it was. And the thing that always started me off with the Freebirds is that they would play, I think they would actually play the Freebird, like, Freebird music. And I just kind of remember, and I think I botched it back then. I think I Sin Cara'd it back then, because I used to tell you about it. I was like, man, like, there's this group called the Freebirds. And it's funny, like, you have these guys, like, because what it was is they used to rock the Oakleys, dude. And I remember you had, like, the kick-ass pair of Oakleys back in the day. You had some nice Oakleys, dude. They were, like, white-rimmed. They had the whole rainbow.
Well, the brow part was, like, neon green. And then I replaced the ears with the clear.
White. Yeah.
It was clear.
Yeah.
And not white.
Yeah.
And then I had the reflective red. Yeah. Lens going.
No, it was better than no. It was kind of like the whole rainbow effect.
Yeah.
But no, I remember you were rocking those, and then they used to come out in Oakleys. I was like, God, like, these guys are flipping cool coming out of the Oakleys, and they came out with this music, and I think they actually came out with Freebird itself. But for some reason, all I remember is just like a big guitar solo in the beginning. It's like, and then like these guys, and then you hear some guy in the background going like Freebird, and that's all that always stuck with me, dude. Yeah. So, you know, I like PSAs. Kind of actually liked them too, because WCW came out with a game on a Nintendo 8-bit, and it was WCW, and they actually, it was like one of the first games that actually had like legit finishers, and PSAs had like the Ghostbuster finisher, but it wasn't going from straight up on top. He would like take him and then he'd plant him with the DDT.
Yeah.
And that's when he had his run with Jimmy Jam, and so you kind of had that whole kind of aspect. And I was actually kind of getting out of wrestling at that time, because I think I was like 13, 14, so I actually like was starting to like get more interested in girls and stuff, and like, you know, kind of put all my attention towards that.
You figured wrestling was prohibitive to getting laid?
Well, no. But anyways, okay. I mean, that's another story. But it was more kind of stuff where we were kind of getting out of that stage of like playing with G.I. Joes and playing with Transformers, and like, we'd watch a lot of wrestling, but then we started watching other stuff, or we started playing video games a lot. And if you want to say it was prohibitive to getting laid, well, video games is one of them. But they're kind of like the last, like, kind of echelon faction that I saw, probably back like in 89, 88, 89. Mm-hmm. And they actually used to go against the Twin Towers, which was Sid Vicious and Mean Mark Callis, who later became The Undertaker. And I think it later on became Dan Spivey. And I remember looking at the Twin Towers like, these guys are really good. But the showmanship of Michael PSAs and just like the whole look they had, it worked. You know, they were from Bad Street USA. Mm-hmm. You know, they just kind of had the whole storytelling aspect of it. I didn't see a lot of matches with them where I said like, oh, I remember seeing this match. But I really started liking them later on, kind of reading Flair's book, you know, and just seeing, like, the way PSAs looked way back when, long blonde hair, just always had a good gimmick going. And the other thing, too, with Arn Anderson's book, saying that, like, you know, he would tell his grandma that he's a wrestler and stuff, and that he's won all these titles and stuff. She's like, yeah, but are you in the ring with Michael PSAs? and if he was in the ring with Michael PSAs, he didn't make it. He finally was in the ring with Michael PSAs, and he's like, well, I was finally able to tell her that, you know, I made it because I was in the ring with Michael PSAs. So yeah. Just one of these guys, and I think it's good for the kayfabe, because he's one of these guys that nobody knows about. They known him as, like, in the 90s, they know him as Doc Hendricks, which was a terrible gimmick. And then he kind of did the whole new Freebirds and the new... He actually started Jeff Hardy and Matt Hardy, and they're the new Freebirds for a while, and he was, like, the manager.
That was when he was doing the Doc Hendricks gimmick, right?
It was after the Doc Hendricks gimmick, and then he became... I don't know what his name came after that. I think he became Michael Hayes again, and he tried to start that whole Freebirds thing, but that time was past, and so... is really just kind of like an old, like, South style wrestling gimmick. You know, it's like South, and this is the storytelling that they do. And they're like guys that came out with Oakleys and came out with, like, cut off denim jackets and stuff and everything. And it worked at that time. And I've been a fan. It's like, it's funny. It's like, you say, like, yeah, it's like, you know, Michael P.S. Hayes. And you're kind of like, yeah, like, great name, you know, great look. Good showmanship in the ring, and it's all you gotta say. It's like
good mic work.
Good. I don't really remember the mic work that much. I mean, is he comparable to Ric Flair? No. You know, is he comparable to Arn Anderson? Probably not. But he's one of those guys where you just say, like, oh yeah, like, yeah, he fought Michael PSAs, or hey, Jimmy Jam, who is actually Jimmy Garvin. Mm-hmm. He wrestled with PSAs as the Freebirds, and you're like, oh yeah. It's just kind of like the whole thing. It's like you say the Freebirds, and you're like, yeah, they were a great tag team, but you never saw them wrestle. And to me, that's really what shows what showmanship can do. Like, I can tell you, it's like, hey, like, he was part of the Freebirds, and the other guy was part of the Freebirds too. The big guy.
Yeah. Terry Bam Bam Gordy.
Yeah, Terry Bam Bam Gordy. He's like, yeah, he was a Freebird.
Yeah.
It's kind of the same thing, like, oh, this guy was a Horseman, or this guy was part of Legion of Doom, or he was a Steiner. Or he was part of the Varsity Club, you know, and just kind of like the old school type storytelling aspects of it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and I think, you know, as a guy that hasn't seen him as much, you know, I mostly know about what he's done through you. The Freebirds is one of the names, and you talk about factions and stuff. I mean, they're right there near the top. I mean, you know, there's the Horsemen, there's the NWO, you're probably going to have to say DX. And after that, you know, you'd be hard-pressed to name a better group than what the Freebirds did. So I think there's that, and then I also like the lasting legacy that they have is the Freebird rule. And I think, you know, as good as the WWE product is, you know, and I like in a lot of ways that they're trying to move forward and do new things, I think that's one thing that's kind of untapped that they should bring back at some point is having some faction. You know, I would have been really happy if it was the Shield, but, you know, if it ends up being the Wyatt family, I'm all for that too. But if they bring back that Freebird rule, it's had enough time away that if they were to bring it back, I think it would gain a lot of traction, this whole thing of having three guys or four guys that any combination can defend that tag team title. And I think it would bring something fresh to that tag team division as well. So, I mean, I think that's kind of a testament to what they did, too, because there's not many teams, you know, there's a few names that end up transcending wrestling, right? Like the Gorilla Position, for example, right? You know, named after Gorilla Monsoon. And then you get something else like the Freebird Rule, named after this team because they were that good of a team. So I mean, I thought it deserved mention. And I wanted to get you a few minutes to talk about your boy.
The one thing I like about the Freebirds, and the one thing that I really liked about WCW program way back when, was that a Freebird match was always fast. It was always a fast-paced match. Not because the matches were fast. I mean, no way was it like seeing, like, say, Rey Mysterio fighting against Ultimo Dragon, both in their primes, where everything is really fast and it's fast-moving, and you're, like, on the edge of your seat because so much stuff is happening. But their matches were always fast because the cameras would always go to the guys in the corner. I mean, the show was in the corner. The guys standing in the corner, not doing nothing. Mm-hmm. Like Jimmy Jam would like do some stupid little dance with his Oakleys on. You're like,
yeah,
you know, like I'm like, man, how does he get his fro that way, dude? He has the whole Toto fro going on right now, you know. But there's always
tape still laying.
Yeah, it's still laying around. Men for Toto, but that's really what it was that their theatrics were so good that when they pan back in the ring, it's like they're ready to do like a setup spot here and there. And it was just a good, fast-paced match. And when you're done, it's 15 minutes have passed already, and they're ready for the commercial segment, and the match is over. You're like, wow, that was a lot of fun. And I think that's really what's missing a lot of times in wrestling, especially WWE right now, is because the matches are really slow paced, and they tell a very slow story in the ring. Where these, like when these guys came out, you know you're going to get a good show. You know that they're going to, like, I don't know who I'm stealing this from, but I mean, in some small part, they're going to, like, reek of awesomeness. You know, you knew
you're
that.
You're stealing that from Edge and Christian.
Yeah, exactly. And that's maybe where they got that from. I don't know if they did, but that was kind of the whole thing, is that you knew that the presentation on the character side, development side, and in the ring was both, were both on high levels, and that's what made their matches so good.
Right. Good, good. So, you know, and as good as they were, and as much as they accomplished, I'm not sure how, I don't think that Michael Hayes ever won the WCW title, and I'm certain that he never won the WWE title, but as we're talking about going into like a series of questions I got, I'll lead off with that question that I had is, who is the best wrestler, or maybe you can give me a couple names, that never won the WWE title? Do you put Michael P.S. Hayes on that list? Or are there better guys you got going that you can come with that?
Off the top of my head, I probably don't put PSAs on top of that list. The guy that always first comes to my mind, and you actually brought up a good point when we were talking about it, I think the number one guy that's never won a world title, the best wrestler, great storyteller in the ring, one of the best guys on the mic that he never gets credit for, is Arn Anderson. I think Arn Anderson is the number one wrestler that's never been a world champion.
Number one guy.
That's my number one guy.
Okay, I think it's funny because I'm going to take another one of your guys and say this guy is the best guy that never held the world title, and that's going to be Scott Hall. I think Scott Hall may very well be the best wrestler that never held a world heavyweight champion. Oh, I think we talked about this last week on the porch, and like I think the first name that came to my mind was Kurt Hennig, and I think Kurt Hennig's on that short list. We might even have discussed that when we inducted him into the Hall of Kayfabe. But as I kind of thought about it over the week a little bit more, I mean, Scott Hall was a great worker, had few equals on the microphone, had the size, had the strength, had everything. I mean, there's absolutely no reason why that guy. I mean. Aside, maybe, I mean, I wonder, I'm assuming a lot of it had to do with, like, his alcoholism and stuff like that. Maybe the companies didn't feel like they could rely on him. But in terms of in the ring and what he brought to the table, I don't know that there's been anyone that's had all the goods and never made it to the top like Scott Hall did.
You can take every guy that we put in the kayfabe and pretty much put them in that spot. Yeah, I agree with you, Scott Hall, and I especially agree with Kurt Hennig, too. The other guy I want to throw out there that we haven't discussed yet, and this one's kind of one more that maybe I have to think about more, but it's kind of one that kind of springs to my mind, mm-hmm. And because we talk about Scott Hall's personal problems and his addiction problems and stuff, and that's what kind of limited him. The other guy, too, I think is going to be like Jake the Snake Roberts. If Jake the Snake could keep his head on straight and be like reliable and stuff, I thought that guy, he had everything, too. I mean, you want to talk about like CM Punk. How he can go back from heel to face in a blink of an eye.
And not have to change personality. To
Jake the Snake.
Right.
And so the best thing about Jake the Snake was that when he had his feud with Rick Rude, I wanted Rick Rude to win. And I hated Jake. I did not like Jake the Snake, even though he was the face. But, hell, it's like he put on good matches. And it was a Saturday night main event,
yeah.
with his wife, Sheila, or whatever her name was. And I thought Rick Rude put on a better match. And I remember you were a big mark for Jake the Snake, and I was like, ah, come on. Like, Jake the Snake only did, like, four or five things. Mm-hmm. But I had to stop myself and really go, like, okay, what's the point here? Why are you getting mad about Jake the Snake or whatever it was? And I looked at the match again. I think I saw it, like, in the morning again, and I rewound it and watched it. And he put on a great match, and he can go back and forth, too.
Yeah, well, I think Jake was a great storyteller. And I think at that time, it wasn't even like we thought about storytelling so much. But, like, just when you think back to the matches, like, that guy would take a lot of abuse, and then he'd always come back in the right spots, and then sometimes, you know, he wouldn't end up winning, but it was always in the right spots. I mean, he, like, I don't know, his match told a good story, and it was always entertaining with him.
Yeah.
And, you know, he had the three direction point and the whirly bird, right?
Yeah, the whirly bird. But the one thing you did bring up good about when I said Arn Anderson was that the reason why you don't feel Arn Anderson is the number one guy was because his sole object was always protect Ric Flair and make sure Ric Flair had the title, and you shouldn't have a secondary guy to kind of be the champion. And my argument to that is that if he would have given the chance to like step out of Ric Flair's limelight and really kind of, and they just focused on him, he could deliver in the ring, and he could more than deliver on the mic. I thought he's one of the best mic guys ever. I mean, I would put his promos up there with a CM Punk promo, with a Ric Flair promo. Small part, you know, I think you have The Rock, you have CM Punk, you have Stone Cold, and you have Ric Flair. All those promos, you can't touch those promos. I think you can put Arn Anderson straight up there, straight in that body of those guys, and he cuts a good promo, if not at other times, better promos than those guys cut. He just never got the exposure that these guys did, and he didn't have the look. But you know,
well, why do you think? Because I think one of the classic moves in wrestling is you have two guys that are super tight, and then at some point they go against each other, and then like the guy that has been the champion, like does the job for the guy that was his muscle or whatever. And how come you think it never was that Flair and Arn Anderson never had some kind of?
They did.
Did they?
They did have it. Yeah, they did have it.
And Flair got over.
Well, what happened? It's funny that you kind of bring it up, and because it really kind of shows Arn Anderson's character. You know, I actually watched it happen, so I already knew what it was. But you kind of read Arn Anderson's book, and he's kind of like in kayfabe, and then he kind of steps out of kayfabe, and so it's kind of funny. Even like the Four Horsemen DVD, he's really into kayfabe a lot because he's still old school. He has to protect the business, so it was a stuff where. There was a span of like 6 months where Arn Anderson beat Ric Flair and beat Hulk Hogan. In like a span of 6 months, he beat both of those guys.
When they're in WCW?
When they're in WCW, yeah. So it was kind of a case where Ric Flair was relying on Arn Anderson too much, and then Arn Anderson started stepping back and wouldn't help out Ric Flair in his matches and stuff, and it kind of all came to a head, and they fought each other, and then Arn Anderson had Pillman with him in the ring, or Pillman came out of nowhere and like and kicked Ric Flair in the head, and then Arn Anderson was able to pin him for the win. And so Ric Flair goes to his new friend Sting and say, "Sting, I need you to help me with these two guys, you know." Like, and Sting's like, "Don't you ever swerve me, because if you swerve me, you know, this, that, and this." And they swerve him.
Nice.
Four Horsemen are reborn with Pillman.
That was when the loose cannon came in.
Yeah.
The Rogue Horsemen.
Yeah, with Pillman. I think it was one of the better Four Horsemen lineups, which could have been, and you can segue if you want to segue into this, but it could have been one of the best Four Horsemen lineups, because you had Flair, Anderson, Pillman, and Benoit. And that's when they had their run as Four Horsemen. And that's when I really started getting interested back in wrestling again, was because of Pillman restarting the Four Horsemen pretty much, because he had two great personalities in Flair and Pillman that were just kind of the same type of character, but Pillman was more loose, and then you had Arn Anderson who had to try to bring everybody back in, and then you had the straight worker in Chris Benoit, and that's when I started becoming a big fan of Chris Benoit, because he's like, you know, same thing we're saying about the Freebirds, you say, Benoit's a horseman, you're like, that's my guy,
yeah.
You know, and then you actually look at this guy like, wow, this guy's really good.
Yeah, that's good. All right, well, yeah, I can segue into the next question then, because that was the other thing I was going to ask you too, was, you know, you're a big horseman, Mark. You've had a lot of guys that you liked in there. I want you to give me, like, two, maybe three names of guys that you thought fit what a horseman should be that never made it into the four.
You know, you asked me this, like, 3-4 weeks ago, not on the podcast, and I still can't wrap my head around it. I was thinking about today, I'm like, well, who could it be? Who could it be? Because all the guys that were in the Four Horsemen, they were perfect for the Four Horsemen. Tully Blanchard, Barry Windham, Lex Luger for a while was in there. Sid Vicious for a while was in the Four Horsemen.
Did you think Lex and Sid were good horsemen? Did you like them as horsemen?
No, I didn't like Sid as a horseman. I mean, I think at the time they needed like a big power guy. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of like, it worked for the time. I thought Lex Luger was good for that fit because they needed a power guy in there that could take on the Road Warriors, could take on Dusty Rhodes and Magnum TA, who they're kind of facing at that time. The wrestler that hurt me the most, because when Henning was supposed to be on the Horsemen, I thought the Horsemen were set for the next 4 or 5 years, because Henning to me was the perfect horseman to actually like fill in that spot that Arn Anderson so famously said, you're going to take my enforcer spot. I thought Henning was like was perfect Four Horsemen material.
Yeah, it didn't happen
because it was a swerve. I can't think of, you know. All
right, let me throw, if you can't think of, let me throw names and then you tell me what you think, okay? Chris Jericho is a four horseman, WCW days.
Definitely.
You think he could have coexisted with Flair and the Horsemen, or you think they're too similar?
No, I think he could have. The thing is, the perfect formula for a horseman is you have Flair's your number one guy. Flair's always going to be the champion. He's going to be the most flamboyant. He's like, he is like it. And then you have the enforcer, which is Arn Anderson. And then you're going to have like a technical wrestler that's either big in stature, but it's just great in the ring. He's like your technician. And you had that with Chris Benoit, and you also had that with Barry Windham too. A lot of people forget Barry Windham, how good he was in the ring. But you had those guys. But then you had another guy who's kind of like a sub Ric Flair, but had his own flair. You know.
So you think let me read between the lines. You think Jericho could have played the Tully role?
Exactly, 100%. Yeah, because everybody hated Tully. And Tully was my... Tully out of... It's funny, like, I talk about the four horsemen all the time. When it comes down to it, Tully Blanchard is my favorite horseman of all time. And I love Arn Anderson. I think Arn Anderson's great. But Tully Blanchard was, like, just like this small fucking guy. You know, sometimes he looked fat. You're like, how the fuck is this guy winning anything? And that's what made him so great was that you have this guy that nobody likes, and he's winning. And then over the course of time, you're looking at him going, like, this guy's actually a really good performer. And he's a good performer because he's a good bumper. He takes a lot of hits. He makes other people look good. So I think Chris Jericho by far would have been way better than Dean Malenko. I mean, Dean Malenko had no personality whatsoever. I think Jericho could have fit that Tully Blanchard mold perfectly because nobody liked Jericho. He can get that cheap heat, the good cheap heat, and I think he could have... Not the Vicky Guerrero heat, but he could have filled the role, say, like what Pillman did. Because Pillman, for a while, was really hot. And when he was in the Four Horsemen, it worked really good. So, yeah, Jericho all the way.
Let me see. What about Rick Rude? How do you think Rick Rude? You think he would have been a good horseman? You think he fit the profile?
I think Rick Rude in early WWF, I think, yeah. If you can take his personality... Not the big bulked up Rick Rude, because Rick Rude when he went to WCW was pretty big. He got a lot bigger.
I'll write it up.
Yeah, you can see the roids having their effect. It really depends though. It's like he never really had. I mean, he kind of had that personality, but that was more. You felt it was more like a gimmick that he was just playing this gimmick, and you really didn't feel that he believed the gimmick that he was playing. Mm-hmm. I really think the Rick Rude that. The way Rick Rude was the WCW Rick Rude when he was with Paul Heyman's Dangerous Alliance and stuff. You know, just kind of like a tough guy that can be the top guy. So the jury's out on that one. I don't know if he would have been a good one, but I would like to see him try.
Let me see. Do I have any other guys I could throw?
Definitely not Paul Roma.
Definitely. He's definitely waxed.
Yeah.
You want to talk about Paul Roma for a minute?
No, I don't want to talk about Paul Roma.
Not at all.
No.
What about pre-WWE move, stunning Steve Austin? Do you think if they had put him as, like, a member of the Horsemen, you think he could have elevated himself being in that group at that time, or you think it wasn't going to happen until he left WCW?
No. I don't think he would have.
Wasn't the right time?
It's not the right time, and he's not the right person either. I mean, He's this redneck from Texas, and I don't think it would ever work. I mean, because the Four Horsemen are—they're kind of like the Yankees. They're the Yankees of wrestling, and so you need guys that are well versed, they're well talked, they dress really nice, and they fit the bill. The only guy that never had to do that was Barry Windham, but Windham every now and then would dress up. But mm-hmm. You know, the look of a champion and stuff, everything like that, dressed up all nice. I just can't see Stone Cold's. Or Steve Austin's kind of brash interview style, where he's just like taking names later, because you look at him in ECW and the stuff he's saying in ECW is just straight off the cuff.
Yeah.
And I don't think that really works for what the Four Horsemen, what they kind of work for or what they do. Because the funny thing is too is that when you're doing the Four Horsemen, all of them have spots to fill. So during that time, who would you have? You would have had Flair, you would have had Arn Anderson, and then Steve Austin and Chris Benoit. It doesn't work because you have two guys that are just no nonsense, and they do all their talking in the ring. And I don't think Flair. I mean, I don't think Stone Cold could cut the promos that he did within the Four Horsemen. I just don't think it would work.
Yeah.
And I don't know who else. I don't know who else would be in there. I mean, I know like. In wrestling, like on our wrestling games, it's like, oh yeah, this guy would be a good Four Horsemen. This guy would be a good Four Horsemen. I just, off the top of my head, I just can't think of any of any guy right now that would be good. I don't know. I can't.
That's fine, yeah. I mean, I wasn't throwing names that necessarily just have you say, oh, yeah, that guy'd be that good, that guy'd be good. You know, I was curious what you thought. And I mean, I don't think it means that you don't think you think less of that guy, but there's a certain fit, there's a certain guy that fits. It wasn't like the NWO where if you wrestled in WWE in the 80s, yeah, you could get in. Like, there's a certain type of guy. I mean, but they had guys that didn't fit the profile.
I think one
guy. Mongo McMichael, yeah. Dude. Well, I don't know why that guy was ever on.
I don't know why he is.
Though he did beat Goldberg.
Yeah. You know, one guy maybe that I can see being a four horseman would be a guy like Edge. I think Edge, in the middle part of his career, even with his run that he had with Christian, I think he'd be a perfect fit for that group. The guy could wrestle. He wasn't overly big, but he had skills in the ring. And I think around those four guys or three guys with Flair and Arn Anderson, I think he could play off those guys, and his promo work would be really good.
I mean, I'm thinking a lot of ways he could have been similar to what Pillman was, like the intense kind of Edge was. Probably something along the lines of Pillman
and a lot of charisma during that time, and a lot of confidence too, and that's really what horsemen were, was just like a lot of, they're really confident. And
well, you say Edge then, so then that's the next question. What about Christian?
I think Christian, when he was doing his Captain Charisma stuff, I think, and if he would have had the same mentality of the Captain Charisma stuff that he did, but didn't use Captain Charisma and just kind of. None of his peep stuff, but just kind of grow into the role. Yeah, I think he could have. And Christian's just kind of this funny guy because he was really hot when he went to TNA, and you know, he cut a great promo, and then TNA buried him like they always bury every other single wrestler. You know, a guy like Desmond Wolfe. I think a guy like Desmond Wolfe could have been really good in the Four Horsemen.
Samoa Joe
as an enforcer.
The enforcer.
Yeah, as an enforcer.
Arn Anderson hands the spot to Samoa Joe. You mark
I,
out?
I would go crazy.
You mark out?
Yeah, Christopher Daniels too. I think Christopher Daniels in the role of like Chris Benoit, or even in the role of like kind of like a Pillman or like that, I think that guy would be great too. Not AJ Styles though. No. Too baby face.
You can't be a podunk.
Yeah. Is it Rick Rude or who's
Bobby?
Bobby Rude. I like, you know, one of those guys, yeah.
Bobby's kind of a poor man's Rick Rude.
Yeah. So, all right. So, we exhausted that pretty good. So.
All right, sure.
So, we are going to now introduce a whole new segment because I'm hearing the pan flute in the background, dude. And this is a segment that I came up with, but it's actually kind of piggybacking off of the pay per view we saw a couple weeks ago, because there was something someone said, like, well, Ming didn't do that. There's no way this guy could do that. So, we're now introducing Ming 101. And Ming is a very important part in our lives, especially with the raising of our kids, because they all know the teeny in the background, and they all know to put the tongue and death grip on, and they all, when they put it on, they have to say huff 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 huff. So this is all you, Ming 101, where we discuss Ming stories and whether they're true or not.
The exploits.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah.
Just one of them though. I mean.
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah. So yeah. Just a little bit more of what he's saying. Yeah, so I was talking about some Ming stories with my son, and he went to school, and he started telling his other friends, like, oh, Ming did this, Ming did that, and all of them, oh, nah, there's no way he did all of that. So that's how, when we got to the pay-per-view, it came back, and some of the kids, not my son, my son's a believer, but some of these other kids, they were doubting the exploits, as it were. So, yeah.
So we first have to preface it that Ming is probably the toughest wrestler, like, in this side of Andre the Giant, one of the toughest wrestlers that you don't mess with.
And Andre apparently didn't want to mess with him either. So, yes, that's true. So we talked about Ming way back in probably somewhere in the first five shows. So don't want to, like, repeat everything too much. But something I didn't really mention before. So Ming is Tongan, right? And the way that he kind of got started was, like, there was this special, like, this special deal that the King of Tonga got, to where he could send, I believe it was six Tongans to Japan and have them start doing sumo wrestling. So him and this other guy named Sion,
the Barbarian,
were among this group of six that went there. They did sumo for a while, and then I think Ming probably had a falling out with one of the trainers. And ended up dropping out of that, but ended up joining up with New Japan Pro Wrestling, and that's how he got started in professional wrestling. So, just as the background of him, you know, if you're a sumo, obviously you're a pretty tough guy. And especially, you know, a lot of those sumos are up in the 400 or 500 pounds. You know, this guy was in the low 300s, but still being able to go against some of these guys, that speaks to kind of his tough, some of his toughness. So I was trying to think, what's the story I want to lead off with? And so I'm going to go and lead off with this one, because I think this one's kind of is pretty well documented. So Baltimore Airport, Meng is in there with a couple of the wrestlers at the bar. And there's some other guys just at the bar drinking up and looking over and kind of noticing Ming and these other guys and saying, hey, those fake wrestlers over there. And like kind of like saying, oh, and, you know, they're fake. They're not real tough guys, right? And, like, and then, you know, Ming overheard this and didn't really like that and walked over and was like, oh, you know, you want to see how fake this is? He kind of went with the whole John Stossel. You want to see how fake this is? But basically...
That's too inside. A lot of people don't remember that. Remember that story.
Okay, well, yeah.
And that wrestler died, by the way, too. That slapped him in the face. Yeah. But yeah.
So he got in a fight with five of these guys, right? So they kind of tried to, like, he grabbed the first guy, and like, these other friends started jumping on him, so he started just kind of, like, punching them off. And then the reason why I really like this one is because he proceeded to actually Tongan death grip the main guy. And then while he had him down in the Tongan death grip, bit the man's nose off and spit it out. And then turned around and kicked the other guy's asses. And in some later interview, when they was asked, like, you know, what's your favorite, like, of the all these stories? He's like, well, that was my favorite one, but, you know, it cost me the most money. And so you could document that he actually did get sued for biting a man's nose off in this Baltimore airport. And, you know, not that it's not an aberration by any means, but... just kind of like a good little indicator of some of the stories you'll hear if you go look. I think we kind of liken him to, like, he's the wrestling version of all the Chuck Norris jokes,
yeah.
Right? All those jokes you hear.
The Bill Brasky on Saturday Night Live too.
The Chuck Norris.
Bill Brasky. Ming once took on 15 guys in his underwear tied over his head. To Ming. But there's two lessons to learn from that. One is, don't ever get drunk in Ming's presence and start talking shit to the guy, because he'll put you in the Tongan death grip and bite your nose off. But the other thing too, as Simu said, was Arn Anderson asked him, he's like, well, who's tougher between you or Ming? And you know, Simu the Barbarian just kind of shook his head. He's like, Ming's the man, dude.
Ming's the man.
So that's Ming 101. It's a good start to your segment. It's a way to kind of bring your boy out. And the whole thing I like about this whole thing was that you like Ming before you heard all these stories.
Yeah.
And it just enhances of what you already like, so.
Yeah, well, it was just like, you know, we're starting doing the show, and I wanted to know some more just different, you know, the real stuff that had happened. I just started looking up different podcasts, different interviews, shoot interviews. And so since Ming was my guy, I started looking up Ming. And there wasn't, I only really found one that he did an interview. But once you start looking up Ming, and then you start seeing all the other shoot interviews of every other main wrestler you ever heard of in the 80s and 90s, and all of them to a man say, yeah, you don't fuck with Ming. So I think that pretty much says it all. I mean, it's an industry filled with tough guys, some fake tough guys, a lot of legitimate tough guys, and pretty much every single one of them would say, that's the guy I don't want to fight.
Yeah, and the other thing that all wrestlers always bring up at the time, too, is that and Ric Flair is famous for saying this, but if you had to pick five guys and your life depended on it for a fight, who would you pick? I don't think he ever mentions Ming, but Ming is definitely one of those guys. He would always mention Harley Race, and people kind of forget about Harley Race, about how legitimately tough he was, because they saw him later on during his years. But that guy was a legitimate tough guy, just like all of your son's friends have no clue who this guy is and think that we're just making this stuff up. It's like, why are you making this stuff? Why would you make this stuff up for? It's funny. Like, I was coaching today, and I told, like, one of the stories about how this guy, like, he like, I knew him since, like, I was 7 years old, and me and him were one-on-one. We're going against one-on-one during the game, and he was just, like, standing on the sideline, just, like, with the ball. And I was like, well, come on, come at me, you know? It's like, if you think you got it, come at me. And so he did this move where he moved, and he left the ball, and I followed him. And the ball was still left on the sideline. And he got me good. And And then but his mistake was he went back to the ball and he looked around at all his teammates and he was like, woo! And so I went and I smashed him. Like, I floored the guy. And then, like, one of the girls, she's like, are all these stories you're telling, are they true? I'm like, yeah, of course they're true. I don't make this stuff up, you know? So, yeah, no, the same thing with me, dude. Like, we have a ton of stories that we can do. I've kind of been looking at all the stories, too. And, yeah, Ming, and as I say, as Barbarian says, dude, Ming's the man, dude. Ming's so, man. I can't front you on that. So, let's finish this off. I'm better. You're better have my donuts.
That would be me.
I'm Bad News Ramen. Follow us on Twitter. You can be part of his 47 followers, or you can be with me and be part of the 321 strong that follow me on Twitter. You know, I'm the man over here, dude. So follow us. Check us out next week. We'll see what's going on, and come back with Hall of Kayfabe and do Ming 101, and we'll have Ming's Jam like we always do. Big ups to the producer for doing it. JP19CA84, maybe it's JPCA1984. I have no idea what it is, but you can be a part of his like 7 followers and make a boy happy over there. So, Moodle Skill 39, we're good to go. Ranio, and we're out.